Hey everybody, welcome back to Cold Case Murder Mysteries. I'm your host Ryan Krause, returning to lead you on yet another fascinating tour of the criminal mind. In this episode, we'll be exploring the evolutionary implications of one of the more heinous acts of consumer terrorism imposed upon American society in the 1980s, which is the notorious Chicago Tylenol murders. On September 29th, 1982, a chain of events began in which multiple people who had recently purchased bottles of extra-strength Tylenol in the Chicago area fell violently ill soon after ingesting the capsules, succumbing to some type of poison. It was later learned the cause of these traumatic sudden deaths was none other than potassium cyanide, which had found its way into numerous packages of the product that hit store shelves around that time. Speculation immediately surfaced that perhaps Tylenol's parent company, McNeil, a subsidiary of Johnson & Johnson, had inadvertently tainted its own medicine, leading to the catastrophe. But this was no accident. The truth is more sinister. These deaths were all intentional. Yet, even knowing that, decades later, we have no clear motive, and worse, the killer roams free. So let's crack open this case and examine the inner workings of the resources at play. The key to understanding how and why this event transpired is the movement of resources. If we follow that path, it should lead us directly to the truth at the end. We might not end up with a guilty face, but we'll know the impetus for the crime. And that's important because this is a crime of great magnitude with a direct correlation to our collective purpose as humans, creating innovative technology. In the process of a crime and its subsequent investigation, you get both halves of what constitutes the dual measures we take to perpetuate our evolutionary plight. The investigative side relates to detection of light, or truth, meaning who committed the Tylenol murders is a question tantamount to pondering who or what created our universe. The other side is integrity, or better yet, prevention. Nature asks us to detect light or movement as predators and, conversely, prevent it when we're in the position of being prey. Predators seek, prey must be elusive. So a killer on the attack is a predator, but when he's being pursued by law enforcement, he becomes their prey. All of which is to say, he's no longer seeking, he's being elusive now. He has to try to legitimize the integrity of his story, in addition to the crime scene, to escape detection by investigators, aka predators. So, integrity and detection are constantly at war with one another in a plight intended to force the creation of increasingly better means of learning the truth. And they do so in the context of ensuring survival. A space shuttle launches in an effort to explore new territory in space, aka detection of light in relation to the truth, but only after being conceived, designed, built, inspected, and maintained by people on the ground below who are dedicated to ensuring the integrity of the craft for the purpose of survival. Nature itself will be the antagonist in that journey, challenging our technology. If we do enough to adapt and overcome adversity, we're afforded a bit more truth. If not, people are going to suffer until we address the weak link and innovate a better solution. Over and over again. In Star Wars, the Rebels blow up the mighty, seemingly invincible Death Star only once they identify its weak spot and attack that technological fragility directly. The Death Star utilizes a 2-meter-wide exhaust port to suffice in having sufficient ventilation, but that width is just big enough to allow the Rebels' winged fighters to enter the Death Star in flight and subsequently attack the station's core. So the Rebels detected a weakness in technological design, specifically related to prevention and integrity, and attacked it to great success, bringing the Empire to its knees in the process. The bad guys, of course, respond by rebuilding the Death Star and do so with the intent to ensure its integrity in relation to attacks and survival. They ditch the 2-meter-wide exhaust port in favor of numerous heat dispersion tubes that are only millimeters wide and also install a force field operated elsewhere. This means the rebels can no longer fly their winged fighters into the exhaust ports and are unable to attack otherwise due to the force field unless they can disable it. So that's what they do. They compromise the integrity of the Death Star too by attacking the station that controls the operation of the force field. Once that prevention measure is exposed as insufficient, new measures must be taken. Often it means a design, or plan, has to be scrapped in favor of something fresh. In this case, what's essentially going to happen is that David, so to speak, will find a glaring weak spot in Goliath's massive structure and hurl a rock right at it. When you attack the place of least integrity, you have the most success because it offers the greatest chance of being undefended in the process of doing the deed. That's the idea here. Expose the lack of integrity and bring the giant down to its knees. That could have happened to the Tylenol brand. Many wonder how they survived. In fact, they thrived in the aftermath of these grisly murders. And how, you ask? Technology. More specifically, technology related to integrity or prevention. It's the same idea as security cameras, bank vaults, padlocks, airbags in your car, etc. If you create technology that improves the chance of survival or gain while minimizing risk of death or loss, evolution offers rewards in the form of resources. Where the perpetrator, or David, will go wrong here is that he'll attack Goliath's weak spot, have success, and then hurl rocks at the same place, only to realize Goliath has adapted, is now using a shield, and isn't prone to the same strategy. Goliath will adapt. He evolves, and doing so negates repetition as an option here. The killer will poison people. The company will evolve. Disaster will be avoided. Unfortunately, it happens too late for the victims who succumb to this monster. And to this day, that person's identity is unknown. Or is it? Let's jump into the terrifying events of September 29th, 1982, that set off this domino effect of poisonings and see what we can gather about our killer. Is he a known entity who barely escaped prosecution? Or someone lurking in the shadows? Okay, so it's the morning of September 29th, around 6:30 a.m., in the Chicago suburb of Elk Grove, Illinois, which is northwest of downtown and located next to O'Hare International Airport. It also borders Des Plaines, where John Wayne Gacy might have dumped a body or two. On this particular morning, 12-year-old Mary Kellerman wakes up to realize she's fallen ill with symptoms of a cold or flu, such as a runny nose, scratchy throat, fever, etc. She alerts her mom and dad, who decide to keep her home from school. Mary is given one extra strength Tylenol capsule, at which point she goes back to bed to rest. But soon after, Mary gets up and goes to the bathroom. Moments later, Mom and Dad hear a loud thud. They run to Mary, fearing she's fallen, and find her unconscious on the bathroom floor. She's taken by ambulance to a nearby medical center, but sadly, she's already enduring cardiac arrest and soon dies. Now, what we have to understand here is that Tylenol is something you take because you already don't feel well, of course, which means when it's mentioned by witnesses that these victims took Tylenol, or the investigation yields that truth later, interested parties, such as the doctors and families, will be inclined to believe the Tylenol consumption was a byproduct of the root cause of the issue. It's not at all uncommon for somebody to not feel well, take aspirin, and then have a heart attack minutes later, or something similar. We generally assume the aspirin consumption didn't cause the heart attack, rather, it was ingested as a means of feeling better. When we become ill, unless it's a recurring condition, or something with which we're familiar, like the common cold, we're often unsure how to treat an ailment. So it's going to be apparent Mary likely succumbed to cardiac arrest, and that she felt unwell prior to that event. A doctor's first inclination will be to think that Mary feeling unwell prior to consuming the Tylenol indicates the Tylenol isn't the source. That means, in this case, the death toll will be dependent upon one thing. Change. How fast will doctors and others detect the source, and equally important, once they do that, how fast and how well will they adapt afterward to ensure prevention or integrity moving forward, including everything from instituting a mass recall on the product to disallowing ease of tampering by way of innovation. The fastest route to that conclusion, tragically, is to link the death to a similar one. So as doctors run tests to try to uncover the source of Mary's fatal illness, death comes knocking again, this time at the door of 27-year-old postal worker Adam Janus, an Arlington Heights resident. The Chicago suburb of Arlington Heights actually borders Elk Grove Village, where Mary Kellerman lived. It's directly north. Adam, like Mary, wakes up with symptoms related to cold or flu, and decides he should take the day off from work to recover. He takes his daughters to and from preschool, stopping at a supermarket on the way back to purchase a bottle of extra-strength Tylenol containing 50 capsules. Unknown to anyone at the time, it's the same brand, size, and contents of the pain reliever Mary Kellerman took. Once Adam arrives home, and his wife assumes watching the kids, he says he's going off to bed to take Tylenol and rest for a while. We assume he ingests the medication, specifically two of the contaminated pills, and lies down in bed. But he never makes a sound after that. He doesn't wake. So his wife checks on him. She finds Adam in bed, but he seems to be having some type of seizure. He's convulsing, and it gets worse at a rate that this couldn't possibly end well. He's dying. Adam soon becomes unresponsive and is thereafter deemed to be in a coma. An ambulance takes him to the hospital, but it's too late. He dies upon arriving there. Of course, it's important to note Adam is not at the same hospital as Mary Kellerman, so they won't have the convenience of connecting the two that way. Now, much like with Mary, doctors believe Adam has succumbed to cardiac arrest, but they're not sure why. And what makes the situation scary is this. Mary Kellerman is dead. Adam Janus is dead. So not only are they incapable of telling anyone what happened, they've also left these poison containers of Tylenol sitting out in the open at the homes of the people grieving their loss. It's a tragedy waiting to happen. And it does. Adam's wife is suddenly a widow, and his children no longer have a father. Obviously, the rest of the family is going to rally around her and offer support in her time of need. So they go to Adam's house after leaving the hospital and console the surviving family members while making plans for the funeral. It's a tough time. These are the types of times when the combination of the sudden onset of shock and stress, combined with not eating or staying hydrated, can leave you with a headache. And if you have a headache and you're at somebody else's house, one in which you just so happen to see a big Tylenol bottle sitting out on the counter, what are you going to do? Indulge a tragedy. So, Adam's younger brother, 25-year-old Stanley, begins to develop a headache. When he informs his wife, 19-year-old Teresa, they go in search of finding medication inside the home. They're not going to bother the widow for something so trivial. Of course, they quickly find the extra-strength Tylenol bottle because it's sitting right out in the open. Teresa watches Stanley take two of the contaminated capsules, and then immediately decides that she doesn't feel well either, so she also swallows two of them. Before long, Stanley is having trouble breathing and suddenly clutches his chest. He falls to the floor and starts foaming at the mouth. Now, this family just endured the strange, sudden, and mysterious death of Adam, and still have no idea what killed him, other than the fact the process resulted in cardiac arrest. And now here's his brother Stanley, clutching at his chest before collapsing to the floor. It's a pretty clear indication his heart has been affected in some way. But again, they have no idea what's causing this, so they don't know how it's spreading. For all they know, it could be an airborne illness, and highly contagious. Whatever the case, Adam's brother has been stricken, and it happens in the same house in which it happened to Adam because they went there to console his widow. So it almost seems like the house itself, meaning the air inside, is the culprit. Is it a disease? Some type of foreign illness brought into the U.S. by a traveler? It's anybody's guess. Either way, the family calls 911. And for a second time that day, an ambulance rushed to the home to try to save a man whose condition says it's not very likely to happen. Of course, it doesn't. Stanley, like his brother Adam, dies due to consuming the tainted capsules. But if the paranoia about the illness being contagious was spreading before, it quickly goes to the next level when Teresa gets sick as they wait for the ambulance to arrive. That means they call 911 again, report another ill person, and have to wait it out with no answers. Teresa doesn't die immediately, but she is, for all intents and purposes, incapacitated by the cyanide. Her breathing nearly comes to a stop, and her brain is just barely operating at a level sufficient to allow survival with the assistance of machines at the hospital where they take her. Sadly, she passes away that same week. Meanwhile, since all of the deaths in the family occurred in the same house, and Stanley and Teresa didn't get sick until they went there, it's decided that the home should be quarantined, inspected, and if appropriate, sanitized afterward. During the inspection, the Tylenol bottle is located sitting out in plain sight, as if it had been used recently. In addition to that, Adam's widow had already reported that he took Tylenol prior to convulsing in bed. However, he took the Tylenol because he was sick, and so it wasn't until this point that it started to dawn on anybody that the Tylenol might be problematic. So it was collected for testing. Meanwhile, the doctor who saw Mary Kellerman upon her arrival at the hospital is starting to have similar suspicions. Everyone realizes the patients are experiencing heart attacks induced by something other than natural causes. Everyone involved is young and healthy, as far as their medical histories show. It won't be long before this riddle is solved. But in the meantime, people will die. So the bottle collected from Mary Kellerman's house ends up matching the batch number for the bottle discovered at Adam Janus's house. Was the batch tainted at the factory, they wondered? And if so, what was the poison? Upon pouring out the remaining contents of the extra-strength Tylenol bottles, the truth was immediately known. They smelled distinctly of bitter almonds. The substance was surely cyanide. And when testing is completed, they confirm their worst fears. So, were there others? How many of these bottles were on shelves waiting for consumers to buy them? And how did the poison get into them? Accident? Sabotage? Misunderstanding? Regardless of the truth, lab testing showed that each capsule was full of approximately 10,000 times the quantity of potassium cyanide that it would take to kill a person. So, whomever takes this stuff is going to die. Nobody's just going to get really sick. Now, the deceased are also tested for cyanide, and high quantities of the poison are present in all of the bodies. Cyanide is generally only detectable after death if A, the testing is conducted within 48 hours, and B, you're specifically looking for it. In addition, the testing on the capsules renders a total of 10 poison capsules remaining between the two bottles found in the Janus home and the Kellerman home. So the company is notified of this breach of integrity taking place with their product, and they jump into action on their end to see if they can identify the cause. The news story is about to break on TV, and word begins to spread everywhere. Meanwhile, around 4 p.m. that same day, 31-year-old Mary McFarland, who was working in an office for Bell Telephone, developed a severe headache. She was a migraine sufferer and had purchased a 50-count bottle of extra-strength Tylenol the day prior at a Woolworths. So, Mary heads into the break room at work to get something to drink to wash down her capsules and returns moments later. But something is wrong. She tries to convey to her coworkers that she's ill. But before she can explain what happened, she drops to the floor unconscious. They call 911, and Mary is taken to the hospital. But she succumbs early the next day. In her purse, the police discover a small container full of various pain medication. Included in it, they locate 10 extra-strength Tylenol capsules. 5 of them contain potassium cyanide. They search Mary's apartment soon after and find the bottle. Inside, only one of the capsules remaining tests positive for cyanide. She had most of the deadly ones in her purse. Now, they get a batch number off the bottle, and as this process of collecting batch numbers continues, what they'll realize is that the contaminated Tylenol has come from more than one production plant in different parts of the country, but the poisonings are all local to the Chicago area. If the product had been tainted at multiple factories, it would be shipped to numerous locales rather than just Chicago. Deaths would happen everywhere else, too. But they don't. So a picture forms. Somebody is likely poisoning the capsules locally and placing them directly on the shelves. Perhaps somebody posing as a customer buys Tylenol, replaces its contents with cyanide, and puts it back on the shelves to be purchased by ignorant consumers. Now, moving forward, 27-year-old Mary Reiner of Winfield, who had just given birth to her fourth child less than a week earlier, dies at a hospital around 10 p.m. that night. Tragically, when she'd left the hospital after giving birth, she was given somewhat of a care package that contained a blister pack of extra-strength Tylenol capsules. A total of 6 of the 8 capsules ended up being contaminated with potassium cyanide. Now, panic almost ensues here because Mary, immediately after taking the tainted pills, dumps the remaining 6 capsules in the blister pack into a regular strength bottle of Tylenol that she has at home. So when emergency services arrive, they locate a regular strength bottle of Tylenol at the scene and believe it might be poisonous, unaware Mary had actually mixed the contents of a blister pack into it. It's not until the mismatched capsules are found inside the wrong bottle that anyone realizes the truth. Either way, it doesn't matter. The company's integrity, as well as that of their product, is toast. The perception will be that all of the products, every last capsule or tablet, are tainted. They're going to have to recall everything. It's going to be a wash, a total loss. So this story breaks, and soon after, hospitals and retail stores are removing all Tylenol products from their shelves. Word of the contamination causes widespread paranoia, leading to an increase of claims and visits to the ER related to poisonings. However, nobody else dies from taking these specific contaminated capsules. Or so they think. On October 1st, 1982, only hours after Teresa Janus finally died in the hospital from ingesting the cyanide at her brother-in-law Adam's house, 35-year-old Chicago resident and airline worker Paula Prince fails to show up for her shift and doesn't call the company to explain. Concerned, someone at the company finally contacts her sister, and they realize nobody has seen her since a few days ago. To be more specific, that day was September 29th, the same day as the rest of the poisonings. So, Paula's sister heads over to check her apartment. Paula is discovered dead in the hallway outside her bathroom door. Inside the bathroom, on the sink, is a 50-count bottle of extra-strength Tylenol. Of course, investigators are going to want to know where she purchased the product. And this is where things get creepy. They learn the purchase happened at a local Walgreens and go there to see, just by chance, if the place has any surveillance cameras that caught footage of Paula Prince buying the Tylenol. It's only 1982, so they don't have any footage, but there's a cash machine or ATM in the store by the registers. It doesn't capture video. It just snaps a black and white photo each time someone withdraws money. So investigators know it's a long shot, but they want to see if there's any chance Paula Prince was present in any of the photos. And she is. It's truly frightening. If you haven't seen this photo, I highly recommend searching for it online. It shows Paula standing at the register making the purchase. She's the only person in that line, and her purse is sitting on the counter to her left, but she's turned towards something on her right in the magazine rack area where they keep items intended for spontaneous purchases. She's either looking at a magazine, chewing gum, candy, or something similar. It could be as simple as a tabloid newspaper. In the near foreground, with their backs to her, we see two young men in line at the ATM. The one at front appears to be the one receiving cash, meaning he's the one who prompted the machine to take his photo. It's hard to tell if these two are together or if the guy behind him is just uncomfortably close for failure to adhere to social norms regarding personal space. Either way, there doesn't seem to be anything malicious going on here. These guys seem pretty innocent. In fact, there are several other people in the photo who were also minding their business as well. But one of them is not. In the background of the photo, specifically the top right corner of the frame, we see a lone man who appears to be standing in place with his hands in the pockets of his light-colored jacket. It's a black and white photo, again, so the best we can do is compare and contrast against other items in the photo. Paula had just gotten off work at the time and departed the airport, so we see her in her uniform, which is quite dark in relation to the man's jacket. Her shirt underneath her coat seems a much closer match to the color of the man's jacket, so here's what I'll say about that. I think the man is wearing a members-only jacket, something that was quite popular at the time, and it's probably tan, beige, light gray, or even white. Now, we can't actually confirm his hands are in his pockets, but it's easy to speculate that's the truth by the angle at which his arms and shoulders rest. Think of the difference between a person standing with their arms at their sides and a person standing with their hands stuffed in their coat pockets. Putting your hands in your coat pockets gives you a bit of a huddled, hunched look in the shoulders, and that's actually as much a product of positioning as it is biological function. We wear jackets to keep warm, put our hands in our pockets to do the same, and place those pockets on garments in places where it causes you to huddle and hunch a bit because conforming to any type of fetal positioning to any degree preserves warmth. There's a slight angle to the arms that brings the elbows back, suggesting the man's hands are drawn back a bit from their natural positioning in order to have them in his pockets. Of course, why is it so important for him to have his hands in his pockets when no one else around him does? He has to wear gloves to prevent getting his fingerprints on the packages of Tylenol when he replaces them. Yes, it's late September, at night, and it's in Chicago, but it's nowhere near the type of weather that gets people in that region wearing gloves. Obviously, you don't want to be seen taking them off in the store after replacing the contaminated bottles for fear somebody would remember that odd detail. So you keep your hands in your pockets at all times unless you're making the switch on the shelf. So you walk in with them in your pockets and you already have these things in your hands in your pockets. You make the switch, or I should say you put them back on the shelf, and then you put the hands back in the pockets so that the gloves are barely seen. Now, the guy at the ATM withdrawing cash is wearing a t-shirt. So clearly, like I'm saying, it wasn't cold enough for gloves, and you couldn't just openly be walking around with them because it would, again, seem to be an odd detail. So to summarize, you walk into the store with your gloved hands already in your pockets, which also conceals the fact that your pockets are full of packages of Tylenol, making it just look like your hands are in your pockets. You walk over to the aisle with your hands in your pockets and only take them out with the contaminated packages already in your hands once no one is looking. In one swift movement, you could replace one package with each hand. It would only take a few seconds to do this a couple of times. But here's a question. Why is he hanging out at the scene of this crime and not at the others? I mean, nobody snapped a photo of him elsewhere or witnessed this man in a way that they'd remember. So why this location? Are we just assuming he could be involved because it's the only place where photographic evidence of the victim exists? No. There's a reason he gets to hang out here and not at the other locations. By this time, all of the other victims have been poisoned, and Paula is just now making her purchase at this Walgreens in Chicago. Now, that doesn't prove anything, but it fits with the reality that this is the only store in the city that was affected. The rest were grouped together out west in the suburbs. So, naturally, if you have to make numerous stops and one is out of the way of the others, you'd either accommodate that out-of-the-way stop before or after the rest of them. Here we have this man at the Walgreens watching Paula after all of the other poisonings have already occurred. He isn't in a hurry because there is no next stop. I mean, consider this. Even in a crowded pharmacy, it's conceivable that one would have to wait a significant period of time for another person to not only select the same brand and formula as the contaminated packages, but also have the bad luck of choosing one of those specific bottles. It could take a while. And you have that time if this is your last stop of the day. All indications are that each of the other stops had already been fulfilled. His work was done. So here he is, hanging out in the pharmacy in Chicago, because it's obviously crowded and he can go unnoticed just walking around and not buying anything. Undoubtedly, he waited until somebody, who became Paula, grabbed one of the packages and, watching at a distance, indulged the sadistic thrill of playing God as she stayed oblivious. Now, what is it in particular that draws suspicion toward this man as the perpetrator? He's staring at Paula like he has laser beams for eyes. If you're a woman and a man is staring at you like this, you know he's trouble. Everybody else in the store is going about their business, but this guy is locked on Paula. Now, to be fair, it's 1982, and Paula is like one of those Farrah Fawcett types with blonde hair and a pretty face that would get a lot of attention from men. Yet, this man isn't close to her. He's not talking to her. He's not making himself known. He doesn't seem to want anything other than to watch her make this Tylenol purchase. He's not even in the right position to follow her out of the store like a stalker might do, attempting to get her at her car, or even just learn what she drives or follow her. He's not lurking behind her and trying to remain concealed. He's staring from a position where she'll easily be able to see him doing it just by turning her head from the magazine rack back to the cashier, which she's clearly about to do as the cashier is processing her transaction. Her hand is in her purse at the time. Basically, she's handed over her money, and while the cashier prepares her change, Paula turns her head around to the right behind her to see the magazines or something else that was there. We only have that photo, but it's clear when she turns back around, she'll be directly facing the strange man at a distance. So what becomes apparent is that he's trying to be seen. He wants her to look him in the eyes, see he's creepy, and then leave the store. Here's what he's doing. He's showing his face to her in the absence of context, but making it clear he's a creep who means business with that stare. That's not something that's going to get her to call the manager over or phone the police. It's just going to be creepy. And then she'll be on her way. But she'll remember this guy being a creep. It's fresh in her mind. So as she goes home, takes the Tylenol she just bought, becomes sick, and collapses on the way to a quick death, she'll remember him. She'll know. That brings him so much pleasure. In her final moments, she'll remember his face. He's doing this because the tragic irony makes it a very powerful story. She'll be standing at the register, making the Tylenol purchase, looking at the man and thinking, "Ooh, this creepy guy wants sex," or "This maniac might follow me to my car or strangle me." But he does none of those things. She gets home safe, sure that everything's fine. Yet soon enough, she learns he followed her home inside the Tylenol bottle. Watching others indulge tragedy in the ignorance of the consequences of their choices and from a bird's eye view is godlike. It's part of the reason we love to watch TV, movies, plays, and so forth. Yet, we are not in control of those tragedies. We don't pull the strings of life in recreations. We simulate the effect. Humans seek greater empathy through increased civility by way of garnering understanding with storytelling. The way we're able to do it is by sitting in God's seat, but remaining empathetic humans rather than being an impartial creator. If you fall down as a kid and smack your face on the street, causing a serious injury, your God isn't going to show up to kiss it and make it better. Mom does that, or Dad, or whichever human cares for you. The design of our universe, whether the blueprint of evolution or the will of a creator, does not change. It is often cruel and equally beautiful, but above all else, its rules remain in place. Evolution, God, or whatever you call it, does not assert logic beyond its design, contrary to the blueprint, or in any way modified from how it was at the start. That is innocence, in its purest form. The design cannot be corrupted by the creator. The creator and the design are synonymous. But humans can corrupt it. No God can put contaminated Tylenol on the shelves at your local drugstore. But plenty of men are capable of such. This ideology goes all the way back to the original sin, and we see that story replicated here, but with inverted emotional values you expect to see when somebody launches an attack against evolution. This man is hurling a rock at the weaknesses of the capsules and the packaging. Adam and Eve, as the first two humans in the story of creation, and in a state of innocence, were instructed by God to not eat the forbidden fruit from the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, or it would destroy them. So, they dine on everything in the surrounding area, but not that particular tree. Soon after, a serpent tells them that they should consume the amazing fruits born of that tree, because surely it won't kill them. He convinces the couple, so they indulge the fruit, and thereby lose their innocence. God returns to find them not only covering up in his presence, shamefully disguising their bodies in fig leaves, but also hiding from him. As punishment for the disobedience, and due to the loss of innocence, God banishes them from the Garden of Eden. So, let's compare that to our killer. Now, all that story does is offer a design for how the human condition came to be. It truly isn't specific to any one religion. Rather, it's reflective of the distinct difference between whatever created us and who we are as human beings. Our Creator is innocent because it is not prone to altering its design due to desire. It is what it is. We are not. We are ever-changing, fluid, flesh-and-blood entities with emotion, desire, and ambition. We are prone to corruption. Our Creator is not. That's what makes our Creator omnipotent. It is perfect because it's a design. We have planet Earth to prove that every human or politician in power indulges corruption. It's unavoidable. To try to have a world operated by humans, but one which is run with absolute integrity, is a joke. In fact, there is nothing in this world that indulges more falsehoods than politics. It's all one big flaming pile of shit. And why? Because we weren't designed to be the captain of the ship. That's evolution's job, aka God, or whatever you call it. The power struggle in society is all nonsense. It's filler. The design is in control. Things are playing out as they were designed. The reason society exists as a manipulation of evolution is that the design in question creates a whole lot of suffering along the way, so we need ample human beings to blame. In reality, the suffering stems from the design and not the faces you see every day. So again, the reason that design works is that God, or evolution, doesn't manipulate circumstances. It only produces organic results in line with its own design. Humans, on the other hand, are not eternal. We are not exclusively a design. We are mortal. And with that, we are prone to desires of the flesh that lead to committing sins. The most devastating part of being mortal is being helpless to the certainty of death imposed upon you by this system, or design, or God. We feel powerless. Some people indulge faith to cope. Some use drugs. Others prefer sex, or crime, or anything. So, in this world, we understand, at least intuitively, that the design is in control. That means when we feel powerless and most desirous of being in control, the most reasonable and available solution is to try to play God in one way or another. Yet, we cannot play God because we're prone to corruption. As a great example, we have countless religious practitioners who have traditionally been considered conduits to the true word of God, but meanwhile, they're molesting little children. We are not perfect. We are corrupt and weak. Even at our best, we keep changing. So, when we assume the role of God in a crime such as this one, what we should expect to see as a result is that the design of God, or evolution, is corrupted to satisfy desire rather than understanding, aka truth. Therefore, the key element is what? Ignorance. Ignorance leads to this tragedy because it's the inverted value of the proper way God handled Adam and Eve. He told them the fruit was poisonous, and they consumed it anyway. So they get banished. There's a lesson involved. But with a human playing God, in the role of a criminal seeking to be all-powerful, there is no forewarning of the danger, nor is there a lesson to be learned at the end. God would offer enlightenment as to the dangers ahead. The man in the Walgreens offers nothing but ignorance. Paula approaches his tree and picks the fruit from it as he stands idly by, watching her undergo this tragedy. He enjoys it. Soon enough, she'll consume that fruit and be banished from Eden, aka dead. And when she remembers his face as she dies, the only lesson to be learned is that he had power over life and death. There is no enlightenment. There is no growth. There's only darkness. Essentially, when you invert the values of being God or evolution by putting a corrupt human in its place, that addition of sin leads to a cocktail called the devil. That's what the devil is, the personification of God by a mortal seeking to gain. God does not gain, or judge, or seek, or anything else. Its power is impartiality. Humans can't remain impartial. When we play God, we burn down the house. So basically, if you were to rewrite the story of the original sin, but replace God with a human, or the devil, it would play out the same way as the man in the drugstore leaving the contaminated Tylenol in Paula's ignorance of tragedy unfolding. God offers a forewarning with the poisonous tree, and later renders a lesson after the mistake, leading to enlightenment. That's evolution. The man in the drugstore offers no forewarning, no lesson, and by extension of that, no enlightenment. In the first example, the goal is evolution, or progress. In the second, it's death. Make no mistake, this man staring at Paula Prince in the pharmacy is the devil. Of course, with all this speculation, we still have to connect him to the case. We can't just say some guy looks strange and was staring, and he's guilty because he just so happened to be there at the time. Thankfully, this photo is quite clear, perhaps not enough to identify anyone without a shred of doubt, but we get a really nice view of this person from the front. The man is white, with an average build, dark hair that's thinning on top, a beard, and glasses. We see that the beard is much lighter on the chin than it is elsewhere, which is generally an indication that the hair in question has gone gray in color. Without a doubt, this picture is even more frightening today than it was at the time, because there's no question that the suspect legitimately looks like the Unabomber, Ted Kaczynski. And really, the guy also looks quite a bit like BTK Dennis Rader. But in terms of facts, the first four Unabomber attacks took place in the Chicago area between 1978 and 1980. And in 1982, Ted's parents did own a home in the area. He was known to stay there from time to time. But Ted isn't our guy, unfortunately. It's a compelling lead, but Kaczynski denied being involved and also said he's never been in possession of potassium cyanide. For me, it's a dead end. Ted was known for wearing all sorts of disguises and doing various other modifications to his appearance to alter his look, even just when purchasing items to make bombs. This is a direct approach on one of the victims in the Walgreens, and if it's Ted, he's not disguised at all. In fact, In comparison to Kaczynski, the man in the photo has a receding hairline at the time that the Unabomber didn't have. That's not something that's too easily faked, and is entirely pointless when your face isn't disguised. The receding hairline seems perfectly genuine. Ted didn't have one. There are also people who want Ted to be the Zodiac because he was in California at the time of the murders. So, there's a lot of desperation, but very little truth. So, we shouldn't be trying to conform the narrative to fit anyone in particular. If the suspect in question has a receding hairline, let's find someone who really does. And when we do, let's be sure that he not only looks like the photo otherwise, but also has some sort of solid connection to the case. Now, 7 people are dead. The company has issued a total recall of their Tylenol products. And without considering the emotional toll on the victims' families, the cost of this catastrophic loss will equate to approximately $265 million in today's money. David hurled his stone, hit the weak spot, and brought Goliath to its knees. Tylenol was off the shelves. Panic ensued. The brand's reputation was damaged. They lost quite a bit of money. Now, we had to ask ourselves why the killer would do that. Was his motive simply to terrorize and kill? I mean, by setting up so many poisonings in one day and in one concentrated location, rather than doing it sporadically in various places, he basically ensured the company would have to take emergency responses to limit what is already very heavy damage. They lost $100 million in 1982 money. So, the murders seemed to be less about the victims and more about the company. If that's true, we can identify what he wants by result of what he ultimately creates. Leverage. David uses the rock to cause damage to a much larger opponent because it gives him leverage by knocking Goliath down. Now that Goliath is down in this story, however, David won't try to finish him off. He'll negotiate. It says killing doesn't satisfy him in and of itself. This man is out to gain something. Essentially, while this person is a killer, he's primarily a con man seeking resources. The murders are a segue to gaining leverage for some kind of negotiation. Well, quote-unquote, negotiation based in criminality such as extortion, blackmail, and similar things. Accordingly, on October 6, 1982, a letter is received at McNeil in their Philadelphia office. It's simply addressed to Tylenol and states the following. Gentlemen, as you can see, it is easy to place cyanide, both potassium and sodium, into capsules sitting on store shelves. And since the cyanide is inside the gelatin, it is easy to get buyers to swallow the bitter pill. Another beauty is that cyanide operates quickly. It takes so very little. And there will be no time to take countermeasures. If you don't mind the publicity of these little capsules, then do nothing. So far, I have spent less than $50, and it takes me less than 10 minutes per bottle. If you want to stop the killing, then wire $1 million to bank account number 84-49-597 at Continental Illinois Bank, Chicago, Illinois. Don't attempt to involve the FBI or local Chicago authorities with this letter. A couple of phone calls by me will undo anything you can possibly do. So, let's consider that. We don't know if the letter is actually from the perpetrator, but we assume it is. This guy has just done $100 million in damage to a huge corporation in a single day. Yet somehow he believes this enormous leverage he's created over the company is only worth a petty $1 million and comparison. That's 1%. And then he offers a bank account number to which the money can be transferred. Seriously? Like, law enforcement wouldn't be called instantly to investigate the origin or owner of the account? That's just very basic stuff. And that gives us an idea of what's really going on here with our con man. The demand is too low, and there isn't enough discretion. Clearly, detectives will easily follow this trail. And maybe that's the point. So is it bait? Yes. The confirmation for me is the fact the person threatens to strike again, as though this multi-billion dollar industry isn't going to make radical changes to ensure greater integrity in their product, and would prefer to negotiate with some half-assed terrorist who doesn't have the resources to win. The text in the letter plays out like Mike Myers starring as Dr. Evil in Austin Powers, where he puts that little pinky finger to his mouth and squeals about wanting $1 million, a pathetic sum in comparison to what the opposition could afford. He has to keep upping the amount so they don't laugh him out of the house. That's basically what's going on here. McNeil is going to read this handwritten letter instructing them to not go to the police. But it's the first thing they'll do. The killer knows that. He wants them to follow this trail. Because it doesn't lead to him. At least, not directly. Or so he thinks. So they sniff out the origin of this letter, starting with the envelope. They trace the postmark number back to a business called Lakeside Travel Agency in the Chicago area, which is owned by a man named Frederick Miller McKay, who is described as an heir to the Miller Brewing Estate. Lakeside Travel Agency is no longer in business, but the bank account number in the letter links to an actual bank account at the company, and that bank account, like the company, has been closed for months. Authorities question the man, but are satisfied he had nothing to do with it. So, they look a bit more closely at Lakeside Travel Agency and learn that before it closed, there was a rumor that Frederick Miller McKay withdrew significant funds necessary to pay the employees' final paychecks, instead using it for himself. So, all of the paychecks bounced, and many of the employees were rightfully upset. But he tells law enforcement that there were two people in particular who couldn't let go, especially the husband. The man's wife, who was a bookkeeper at Lakeside Travel Agency, bounced her check for more than $500, a nice sum at the time, and was never reimbursed. In fact, she ended up paying fees in relation to it, meaning she lost money on top of the bogus paycheck. No matter what the couple did, though, they couldn't recoup her money and left the situation bitter. Even a state hearing to appeal for the pay yielded no positive results. Of course, it's interesting that, among all the positions at the company, the wife just happened to be a bookkeeper. That suggests that she might have that account number. But what we can see is that this started as a dispute over a paycheck, and grew from there. It became something bigger, especially in the minds of those scorned. In addition to that, like I said, we learned the account had already been closed for 5 months, as it ceased to exist when the business closed, so it wouldn't even be possible to wire money into the account. If that's true, there's only one reason to point the police in that direction: trying to frame Frederick Miller McKay for the Tylenol murders. So the FBI looks into this couple, Robert and Nancy Richardson, and soon learns those are fake names. Why would this couple be living under pseudonyms? Well, the real people, James Lewis and his wife Leanne, had reason to keep a low profile. Unfortunately, they found themselves connected to trouble elsewhere. Now, we'll discuss that in a moment, but what happens first is the FBI learns Robert Richardson recently worked at First National Bank of Chicago. They get handwriting samples from the company's files and check them against the style used in the extortion letter. It's a match. Not maybe. This guy wrote the letter. So the cops go looking for him to make an arrest. But Richard and Nancy are gone. They've vacated their apartment and taken off. It's not clear where they went. But what soon becomes apparent is that those names, as I said, are aliases. Not only are they hiding now, but for some reason, they were already hiding from the truth. This is where that trouble I mentioned comes into play. Apparently, both James and Leanne, aka Robert and Nancy, were working as bookkeepers a while back when they lived in Kansas City, and a dispute between Robert and the owner of the company left him hitting the bricks and taking his wife with him on the way. They decide to start their own business preparing taxes. It's at that time they take on a client named Raymond West. He's a 72-year-old retiree who lives by himself. In July 1978, a friend files a missing persons report after repeatedly failing to get Raymond to answer the door at home, while he could see that Raymond's car was still clearly in the garage. Plus, there's a note wedged in the front door that advises anyone looking for Raymond to call Jim instead because Raymond is out of town. The note is written on letterhead from James and Leanne Lewis's new business. Jim, of course, is James Lewis. But right from the start, this should strike anyone as odd because the letter would normally be written by Raymond and referring them to James in his absence. It's his home. He's going out of town. People are looking for him. James Lewis just handles the man's taxes. But one thing matters above all else as we consider what the letter means in its subtext. It says Jim is in control right now. It isn't Raymond telling us he's not around. It's Jim telling us that Raymond's not around. So we're going to go back to James's childhood to garner an understanding of why control is at the core of his emotional wound. But for now, the police are going to enter Raymond's home. On the coffee table inside, they discover another note. This one is signed by Raymond, but authorities soon learn the handwriting isn't his. However, the note requests that they don't disturb him because he's sleeping late. Now, this guy has one note wedged in his door outside, written by someone else, that says he's out of town, and that someone else will be taking care of his affairs in the meantime. But inside the home, on the coffee table, is a note signed by him suggesting that he isn't out of town at all. He's actually asleep in the bedroom. Of course, something is wrong here. Obviously, these notes aren't intended to advise anyone of the truth. They're intended to obstruct it. They send one message loud and clear. Don't go any farther. It says stop here and turn around. There's one outside the door. There's one inside the door on the coffee table. And they are both entirely different methods with a totally different truth. So these are just acting as detours from the actual truth. And it's a terribly desperate strategy. But the cops buy it. They see the note, do a 180, and leave. They don't come back for another 3 weeks. And that's when they learn what was being hidden. Upon entering the house, they smell something. Death. It's not ground beef rotting. It's not a full trash can in the kitchen. Nor is it a decomposing squirrel stuck in the chimney. There's no mistaking the source. It's human. So they go to Raymond's bedroom after getting no response when calling out. His bed sheets are covered in blood. And worse, he's missing. Investigators search the rest of the house. In the basement, there's a bag containing Raymond's glasses and his hairpiece, both of which are bloody. Even more prominently, right out in the open, there's a folding chair covered in blood, as though someone had been sitting in it while bleeding. It seems consistent, at least to me, with torture. Along with the bloody glasses and toupee belonging to the homeowner, a picture is starting to emerge. More specifically, what I'm saying is that somebody wanted something from him, and he wasn't willing to relinquish it. But who? And what? Better yet, why can't they locate Raymond? That's when one of them notices some sort of stain running vertically down a wall in an upstairs bedroom. It's not a water stain from an old leak. It's still fresh. Wet. They come to understand there's an attic above them, and they venture up there. In the attic, they find Raymond West's body, wrapped in sheets and stuffed into trash bags. A cause of death couldn't be determined, but we know this for sure. Raymond's legs were hacked off, all the way at the top of his thighs by his hips, and placed in the bag with the rest of him. So, nobody is ever going to tell us why his legs are missing, but I think what's pretty clear is that the killer began a process of dismembering the body, soon finding it so messy and difficult that it would be futile to try to cover up the death completely, given the excessive gore. This is a plan gone awry. I think the idea was to extort Raymond, and it ended up in murder, either because he refused, the killer was demanding something he couldn't accommodate, or whatever the case may have been. The murder seems to be a byproduct of whatever torture took place in the basement, and the torture, of course, would have been inflicted with the intention of coercing something. Well, it doesn't take the cops very long to answer who, or even why, for that matter. Obviously, due to the note on the front door, they're going to look at James Lewis first. And what they learn is that James Lewis wrote himself a check for $5,000 out of Raymond's bank account, which, of course, would be significantly more money today. And it was subsequently cashed. James tells the cops that Raymond actually wrote him the check as part of a business loan. Except, guess what? Now we know why it seems like Raymond was getting tortured. No one in his circle of friends or family could believe he would do such a thing because he was incredibly stingy with his money. James Lewis learned that the hard way. It seems old Raymond likely refused to be extorted or coerced by James. And it cost him his life. So James Lewis is charged and the case goes to trial. But here's the thing. If they can't determine the cause of death, it's difficult to establish the manner of death, meaning you could argue something isn't murder, despite outwardly appearances, because there's no proof Raymond was killed. In fact, at trial, it's argued that his high blood pressure could have been the cause of his death. Yet, he's in a trash bag in his attic with his severed legs stacked on top of him. I have a wild imagination, but not one suitable for understanding the logic required to legitimize that notion. Regardless, James Lewis is being charged with murder, so the trial isn't about being held responsible for dismembering the man after death. Sadly, they can't prove James Lewis murdered Raymond West, and he's a free man. Of course, now James and Leanne need a new scheme. They turn to credit card fraud, but don't seem to be very good at that either, as the police catch on to them and a warrant is issued to apprehend them. They're forced to flee Missouri and find their way to Chicago, where they adopt the names Robert and Nancy Richardson. This wasn't something new for James. He was known to have used numerous aliases in the past, perhaps as many as 24. He knows the ropes. That's when Nancy, aka Leanne, gets the job at Lakeside Travel Agency, but it actually closes just a few months after she's hired. Robert, aka James, had been working at the First National Bank of Chicago, but was unemployed when Leanne lost her job with the closing of the travel agency. That last paycheck was a big deal, and given that the dispute grew over time, without recourse, James exploded. Of course, that's when the Tylenol murders take place, and then police get the names of Robert and Nancy Richardson before learning they're actually James and Leanne Lewis. But what they don't know is where the couple fled this time. Meanwhile, James starts writing letters to various outlets professing his innocence in the crime, and just as had been the case with the letter postmarked from the travel agency, police are able to trace these mailings back to New York. Much of the correspondence is being sent to the Chicago Tribune, so investigators believe they might be able to catch James buying a copy at one of the newsstands in New York that sells them. Yet, it doesn't happen. Nobody ever spots the guy. That's when they decide to check local libraries, thinking perhaps he's going there to read publications to avoid being seen purchasing an out-of-town newspaper on the street. And soon enough, that's exactly where they find him. James is arrested, causing Leanne to surrender in the aftermath. But here's the issue now. There's plenty of evidence James Lewis wrote the extortion letter to McNeil, or Johnson & Johnson, in Philadelphia. The handwriting is a perfect match, and his fingerprints are on the letter. Yet, there's no evidence he committed the murders. Does he look like the man in the Walgreens photo we believe is the perpetrator? Yes. But the man in the photo, regardless of suspicion, isn't committing a crime. Now, Lewis's fingerprints were also a match to a letter written to U.S. President Ronald Reagan in which he demanded some type of tax overhaul or else the Tylenol murders would continue. I mean, look at the theme present in all of this. It's the little guy with no power turning every which way to hurl stones at much larger and more powerful entities who can squash him like a bug. But he persists. It's really delusional. But I think if we go back to James Lewis's childhood, we're going to learn exactly what precipitated this irrational disposition he harbors. So James was abandoned by his biological parents at age 3, something of which he was cognizant, and, of course, he was adopted soon after. He was bitter about it, and refused to show respect for authority in the new household, as a result of believing he wasn't really the couple's child. He verbally and physically attacked his parents with regularity. Among the incidents included angrily taunting his mom with an axe after going off the rails, and then another incident in which he broke his father's ribs and got charged with assault. His abandonment by his biological parents, after an age in which he'd already bonded with his mother and developed relationships, left him with a burning desire to not only control powerful entities, but make them pay attention to him. He wants them to know what he can do. He's in control here. He wants to show his power like he did physically to his adoptive parents in the absence of any other means. That mental illness is a byproduct of the worthlessness and anger he felt as a result of being unwanted and abandoned by his biological parents. You can even see it in the choice of where he sends the extortion letter and how he addresses it. He sends it, quite literally, to the parent company. The top of the letter reads, quote, Johnson & Johnson, parent of McNeil Laboratories. Notice that, just as it was in James's childhood, the parent here, so to speak, is being told what to do by someone who is small and insignificant in comparison, using the threat of violence as leverage over their authority. That's exactly what he did to his adoptive parents. And why? Not because he hated them, because he hated himself. We know that. The abandonment led to feelings of worthlessness. And here's where we get to the part that tells us why he chose these Tylenol deaths to be overdosed by way of over-the-counter painkillers. James Lewis tried to commit suicide as a teen, using over-the-counter painkillers, and he survived. It lands him in a psychiatric hospital, where he's diagnosed as a catatonic schizophrenic. The medication wasn't strong enough to kill him. So what does he use in the Tylenol murders? Not only does he choose extra strength Tylenol, but he replaces the contents of the capsules with something even that much stronger, cyanide. And even then, he uses a tremendous amount of cyanide, many times in excess of what it would take to kill a person. There's no chance that anyone who took this was going to survive. Now, Johnson & Johnson represent the two parents. McNeil represents James Lewis, physically, and the Tylenol, which McNeil produces, is his emotional state. Johnson & Johnson seek to give McNeil the proper environment and tools to cure what ails people in their heads by producing Tylenol with the right ingredients, just like James's adoptive parents seek to fill his emotional state with the right ingredients that will cure what ails him in his head. But no matter what Johnson & Johnson provides McNeil, or what James Lewis's adoptive parents provide him, the Tylenol, aka his mental state, is poisonous. And in both cases, James Lewis supplies the poison. The disagreement over Leanne's paycheck got so out of control by way of James's reactions for this reason. An employer, from a financial and professional standpoint, is like a parent. They are the dominant entity in the business environment. Essentially, employees are children and employers are parents. And when Lakeside Travel Agency closed, with the boss skipping town with the final paychecks, there's no question what element rang an alarm bell in James's mind. Abandonment. They were left with nothing. He just took off. It was about a whole lot more than $511. That event mirrored his childhood. If you recall, James's reaction to getting stiffed for Leanne's paycheck was far worse than hers. James was on the verge of becoming completely unhinged due to that. Of course, you might also remember what I said a few minutes back about the couple leaving a job where they worked together as bookkeepers. And what caused that? James freaked out on the boss and refused to work for him anymore. It was supposedly over something insignificant. But look at the theme at play. Parent and child, aka employer and employee. It isn't a coincidence James has no job stability, as his ability to reconcile any relationship involving that same power structure against his past of being abandoned is impossible for him. He's angry. Moreover, look at the way his past affects his identity. It's no wonder he's had a few dozen aliases. His biological parents abandoning him for adoption after he was already 3 years old left him growing up feeling like he didn't know who he was, as though his adoptive family just provided an alias, a new name, and location. After being abandoned, he never felt at home, and guess what happens? He lives a life on the run, changing identities with each rebellion against someone or something that represents a parent or control. He wants to hurt them, to take. He wants revenge. But what we notice, above all else, is that James wants to be the top dog here. He wants to be in the parent role, in control of everyone and everything around him. Those with the resources get to play that role. those without remain subordinate. The only avenue for bucking the system is to indulge crime and play God, aka the parent. James has to pretend, and in doing so, his only resource is violence. From Raymond West to the seven Tylenol deaths, James attempted to manipulate acquisition of resources by playing God with people's lives. He had nothing else. Now, James Lewis claims he wasn't in Chicago at the time of the poisonings. He says he was in New York already. But I'm guessing nobody believes that story. He's a con man. It can't be proven one way or another, though he seems to be the man on camera staring at Paula Prince in Walgreens. What we can say for sure is that he penned the extortion letter. And for his efforts, James Lewis is sentenced to 20 years in prison as punishment. It's said that 20,000 people were considered persons of interest in the Tylenol murders, and 400 of them were examined closely as suspects. But it remains unsolved. Perhaps the closest match outside of James Lewis is the tragic tale of Roger Arnold. Arnold was employed at a dock that received many deliveries of products, including the Tylenol in question. While drinking at a bar one night, he was overheard by the owner bragging to a few patrons that he had poisoned people with cyanide. The bar owner proceeded to turn him into police, and he was detained while a search of his apartment was conducted. Inside was somewhat of a lab, and the setup was producing some type of white powder. There were also several guns present, among other oddities. Investigators thought he was the guy. But the powder turns out to be harmless. It's something used for glass production. Unfortunately for Roger Arnold, by this time, his reputation is ruined, and he's been put through the ringer by the cops. He's furious at this result, and wants revenge against the bar owner because he'll never be able to shake the suspicion despite being innocent. So he gets a gun and waits in ambush for the guy. When the bar owner passes, Arnold hastily shoots him before he can react. Which is a shame, because it's not the bar owner. It's someone who looks like him. Roger Arnold kills an innocent man and goes to prison as a result of his pride. Despite not apprehending the guilty party, Johnson & Johnson puts Tylenol back on the shelves soon after, with major upgrades to packaging that include a triple seal. Soon after, the gel-coated tablet is developed, and the capsules which were so easily tainted become obsolete. Since that time, the industry's introduced many more measures related to ensuring integrity in their products. That's evolution. Action, reaction, new understanding, improved methods, more enlightenment. And guess what else? There are so many suspects in the case, even beyond what law enforcement can reasonably handle, and it forces them to develop new computer software related to tracking suspects specifically for this occasion. So look what society gets. Seven dead, grieving families, public terror, mass confusion, monetary deficit, no justice, etc. It amounts to suffering and irreconcilable loss. Now check out what evolution gets. New software related to detection, which was a huge achievement back then in 1982, and new standards for integrity on medicine containers. One searches for light, aka truth, the other ensures survival. In the process, evolution fulfills both sides of its dual need, detection and integrity. Evolution does not have to suffer. Only society will suffer. They'll do its dirty work. And to be those mindless robots, society must be a veil over evolutionary truth. You see a world before your eyes that is equally rampant in destruction and creation, light and darkness, good and evil, growth and decay, hope and despair. It is that way by design, but always feels as though we could change it if we just tried harder. But we can't. Human nature dictates there is no need for the world to be good and pure in order to progress as a species. In fact, the opposite is true. Peace is death. Only in society is peace conducive to survival. So, if we are designed to evolve, and do so in the context of ensuring survival along the way, then conflict is our only means of evolutionary progression. So for evolution, 7 people getting poisoned and dying terribly tragic deaths by way of outrageous levels of cyanide ingestion, while simultaneously spreading rampant fear and paranoia, is wonderful. That's how evolution was designed to work. And it's an ugly truth. We're the guinea pigs in this lab. But there's no way to have a world that progresses in civility and technology without developing negative responses to unwarranted violence. Those things are integral to having hope about making a brighter future. So as evolution has conflicts play out in perpetuity every day in society, all of its dirty work that gets carried out by human faces is labeled on Earth as good and evil. History remembers people for those qualities, but sees its creator as indifferent. We often hear of God as a silent witness. He watches over the choices of sinful humans who betray the innocence in which they were created. The notion of God creating the world and sitting back to watch is the same as evolution being a design. They don't interfere explicitly because their influence is inherent in the design. And what all of this means here is that the victims and those who love them get no justice. But that's the point. If integrity of the product isn't ensured by way of technology, and detection-related innovation isn't sufficient to find a suspect, we must evolve. James Lewis, when all is said and done, had the motive to commit this crime. The psychological profile I provided from a behavioral analysis of the suspect lends itself to a solid match with the actions of the perpetrator in the Tylenol murders. Combined with the photo at Walgreens, which seems to be him, I think he's guilty. And while I have great empathy for the victims, for me there's a profound calling in the subtext of their suffering. A primal place in our soul, speaking to our Creator, not just about this incident, but about the human condition itself and our collective emotional wound. As though talking to a parent who abandoned us so long ago, we can't remember, but for a vague feeling that somehow we know who it really is in our hearts and are still waiting to reunite one day. I think that's what hope is. In those moments, after they ignorantly took the poisonous capsules, and certain death was upon them, leaving them no illusion survival was ahead, they lost hope. They were abandoned by their Creator, banished from the Garden of Eden. And in their last breaths, alone in their fate, there's no doubt they had one question. Why? Not just this horrible fate, but all of it. Every bit of the suffering humans endure. Here on Earth, We have no answers to that question. We can only have faith. Because somewhere, way out beyond the stars of our galaxy, and even beyond the borders of the universe itself, there is a secret that waits in silence, indifferent to what transpires between now and when we finally reach that place. And as those answers remain mysteries, and always have been, we continue our plight to uncover the truth waiting for us at the end. We believe. We don't know why, except that we were designed that way. There's something about us that feels like we're all kids, stranded out here on our own, in an unfamiliar world, doing the best we can to survive as we grow and mature and are eventually ready to return home, having learned our lesson. Just like in the stories we tell. And perhaps the most important element in those stories, the one that resonates with us most, is when we see a protagonist who is lost and can't find her way back home. There's a reason that The Wizard of Oz is still popular after more than 80 years. Because we are all that kid from Kansas, losing our innocence, growing wise, and traveling the yellow brick road together in our journey to finally unveil the wizard. There's a reason he's behind a curtain in the movie. When Toto pulls back the curtain at the climax, it symbolizes society pulling back the curtain on evolution. That moment, that's when we learn the truth about who we are and what brought us here. And if we're lucky, we too will find that the omnipotent creator we believed was so huge, mighty, and powerful was nothing but a small, meek, lonely person like us. Yet, what did he use to create the facade he was godlike, an all-powerful being? Technology. He uses machines to manipulate a presence greater than his humanity. And this powerful man who uses machines then bestows upon his guests, the Scarecrow, the Tin Man, and the Lion, the attributes they lacked when starting their journey, and which forced them to band together in order to reach their goal. Of course, Toto was a dog, and not part of human evolution, and the supporting characters here are humans playing animals or inanimate objects because they have to be afforded human traits as gifts at the end for us to relate. But what about Dorothy? What does she get? That's what we really want to know. She's the protagonist of the story, the driving force. She's each one of us. Well, what Dorothy desires more than anything else in the world is to rest from this long journey. She's matured and discovered the truth. It's time to go home now. That's her wish. She wants to go home. And guess who's going to take her? The wizard. Because as it turns out, he's from Kansas originally too. Just like her. He knows the way home. And so, they're about to take flight in this big hot air balloon, giving them a bird's eye view of the world, like gods should have, to witness the beauty of all their creations. But as they start to rise, Toto jumps off the balloon, as dogs, like I said, aren't part of human evolution, and can't go there. Of course, we, as humans, are not actually at this place in technology yet where we would intersect with our creator. That's just part of the story on screen. So Dorothy has to get off the balloon too. She can't go where the wizard's going by those means until humanity is truly able to get there. The wizard ends up flying alone, being the sole god in the sky above them. At least for now. That flight represents where we're going. But for now, all of us are still grounded. So to represent that, Dorothy not only has to go back to Kansas, but her method of doing so, instead of being technology capable of flight into the skies and beyond, will be shoes that represent the current earthbound plight of the times. The shoes are red to symbolize blood, the most prominent feature of mortality. But if she had taken that flight and learned firsthand the secrets of our existence and returned home having been enlightened like never before, what would she tell us? What mysteries would unravel before our eyes in breathtaking fashion? We don't know, but when we find ourselves in that place, finally ready to understand the reasons we've been kept ignorant and the purpose of enduring endless suffering, we'll be in position to answer the most profound question ever. Why? And for each victim of any crime the world has ever known, we'll have justice. That's of the greatest importance because each of us, individually and collectively, as human beings, are victims of the greatest crime ever perpetrated. Mortality. We want to know why we were created in this likeness, abandoned in our infancy, forced to struggle alone through our journey, and finally, condemned to death. That's exactly what James Lewis wanted from his parents. He wanted to blame them. He wanted to understand. But he needed to move on. He never evolved, so the past swallowed him. And as he drowned, spiraling downward into oblivion, he took other people with him. So if there's anything I want to leave you with about this incident, it's to remember that wherever you're headed, you'll almost certainly be inclined to take others along for the ride. With that being the case, why not turn your back to the shadows, travel in the direction of the sun, and as its rays fade and it dips beneath the horizon, bringing forth an eternal night? Know that no matter what comes next, you refuse to take life, in a direction that denied others of hope. Because when you follow the light, it tends to follow you. And in a world where so many terrifying things are lurking behind us in our ignorance, ready to pounce, maybe the most comfort we'll ever feel is knowing that the thing chasing us is a friend.